How do you do, everyone, for today's chapter in the 1949 edition of our Passing Parade, which brings us to the fourth out of five men who appear to have, in fact, led the double life of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. After the announcer has his opening, we'll transcribe some notes about Francois Villon, the cutthroat college professor of the Passing Parade.
Now, here is John Nesbitt.
Watching the procession move by again, there is no question that the man known as Francois Villon is one of the great human mysteries of time. The fact is, for every piece of true evidence about him, there are half a dozen legends. One reason for this is, of course, that nearly 500 years have passed by since he raised Cain on a large scale in his native land of France. But the second reason is that this man, whoever he really was, deliberately led several hidden lives. He was Dr. Jekyll, the student of science, and he was also Mr. Hyde, the murdering savage. He was also a genius who wrote delicate poetry, and at least once he was a young and gallant lover with a heart filled with the highest human devotion. So he wasn't a man, he was a gang, and he managed to gain so much attention in his various roles from thief to gentleman that he has never been forgotten. For five long centuries, we have sung songs about him and told our children the legends of his adventures. If you remember the musical comedy in the movie that was called If I Were King, in which a beggar happens to be given a chance to rule France for a day, that is one of the stories that has come down to us from the life of Francois Villon. He lived in the city of Paris 40 years or more before Columbus set out to find the New World. And during those times, Paris was as dangerous a place to be in as the Casbah of Algiers or Hell's Kitchen in New York a generation ago. You would not conceivably walk through the narrow alleys of Paris after dark unless you were with a group of torchbearers and armed guards. You wore a steel shirt under your coat. You carried at least one dagger ready at all times, and you knew how to use it fast. If you didn't learn how to stab and slash in a hurry, you didn't grow up. You were extremely dead in the gutter. There were, we think, 304,000 people then jammed inside the walls of Paris. And with the first fading of daylight, nearly everyone entered his house, locked the doors, and pulled heavy iron shutters fast over the windows. Your house was literally a fort which you had to guard to stay alive. During the darkness of the night, the only humans who moved through the alleyways of Paris were armed soldiers, thieves, street women, beggars, armed mobs of gangsters, and the uncounted groups of people known as the sewer rats. These were the outlaws who managed to survive for years by living in the immense sewer tunnels and catacombs which lie under Paris to this day. Now, there were also nearly 4,000 saloons, taverns which remained open until morning. They were filthy, steaming dives which only a company of soldiers could smash into unless they knew the password or were invited. They were speakeasies. One of the 4,000 drinking places was called Le Diable, the Devil's Inn. The specialty of the proprietor was in serving the toughest and most abandoned wastrels of the city. The Devil's Inn was a criminal's den and proud of its reputation. At a little oak table in the corner, a few feet from the fist-fighting, knife-waving, screaming drunk customers dancing in the middle of the room, six thieves sit planning a robbery. They are all young men, scarred like pirates, which is exactly what they are. They are killers, hoodlums, stranglers, poisoners, cutthroats, footpads, pickpockets. The robbery being planned is a typical job of muscle, blood, and violence. A wealthy lawyer is known to have received a large amount of gold for a recent case. He has the money hidden somewhere in his house. So the gang will simply go there, burst the door open, yank the man out of his bed, and torture him until he reveals the hiding place for his gold. If it is in a locked iron strongbox, they will shove red-hot coals under his arms until he opens it for them. The leader of this group of six assassins is a very thin fellow. He is very young and boyish. He is only 22 years of age. He is sharp-faced. He has a long nose. He has black, shining eyes. His mouth is twisted from a bad knife cut. He is known then as now by the name of Francois Villon. Just before dawn, this unlovely boy leads his gang to the lawyer's house. They break in and they shove splinters of wood under their victim's fingernails and then light the wooden slivers and let them burn down to the fingers. Screaming with agony, the lawyer shows them his hidden supply of wealth and they go laughing out into the streets again, racing ahead of the guard. They divide the gold, they say goodnight to one another, and they start home for bed. Not, however, the scarecrow thin boy called Francois Villon. He runs through the streets, he skips across the ancient stone bridges, and he trots into the town which is built around the University of Paris, which was then, I believe, the most famous institution of higher learning in Europe. Villon dances into a tiny student's apartment in a tall building. He rips off the filthy, blood-stained leather jacket he's been wearing, and he climbs into a dignified black robe, just like the graduation gowns we use in college ceremonies today. He fits the mortarboard cap on his head, the square flat affair with a tassel that's still used at graduation ceremonies, and then he folds his hands together in front of him like a priest walking the aisle, and he goes across the courtyards toward the lecture hall. At the College of Sorbonne, he quietly pushes open a pair of tall bronze doors and goes into an auditorium. It is a room like a chapel with stained glass windows. On a platform at one end, there is seated a circle of 25 professors and priests, the complete college faculty. They are meeting to examine this young man with the purpose of qualifying him for the degree of Master of Arts. The examination lasts for hours. To the faculty of the college, the young man is known as François de Montcorbier, for apparently he used Villon as his underworld moniker. But in any case, he has an astonishing education. He speaks Greek and Latin and Hebrew fluently. He is brilliant in mathematics, in astronomy, in metaphysics, in history, in philosophy, and above all, in theology and religion. The entire examination is conducted in Latin or Greek. He finishes it not merely with honors, but in triumph. He is graduated as a Master of Arts with one of the highest ratings in history. He is now a college professor, a learned authority. He can enter a dozen dignified positions in church and government merely on the strength of his distinguished title and record. Instead, within 2 years, he is in the torture pits of the prisons, for François Villon was a true Jekyll and Hyde. He was a man compelled to lead both the lives of a scholar and of a monster. We'll pause 60 seconds here for the announcer before coming to the darkest adventures of this famous conundrum of time's passing parade.
Now again, John Nesbitt.
On the reviewing stand again, in the two different pictures we offered of François Villon a few moments ago, you see the entire life story of this violent man. In both his roles, one as a cutthroat and the other as a scholar and a professor, he was completely sincere. He received his master's degree in 1452. He had 11 more years in which to lead his various lives. He fell in love with a beautiful woman. Her name was Catherine de Vaucelles. François Villon loved her ardently, and we believe respectfully, and perhaps that was the wrong thing to do, for the lady, having learned of his double life, chucked François over. He never recovered from a sense of heartbreak, and for the rest of his days, he made a kind of a religion out of the memory of this one woman. He moved deeper into the underworld. Even at the Devil's Inn, they came to fear him. He killed like a rattlesnake. In 1454, he stabbed and killed a priest in a street brawl. He ran out of Paris, but he was caught, returned, and sentenced to death. But some pity for him, a recognition of the enormous prestige that he'd had in his other life as a scholar, caused him to be pardoned and set free. A year later, he was back in jail for robbery. Again, he was pardoned and exiled from the city of Paris for life. But because his beloved Catherine lived in Paris, Villon returned. He was caught by the authorities. He was dragged in chains to a place called the Bastille at Meun. There he was tortured in a system which was called being put to the question. You were stripped naked, stretched out on the floor with cords tied to wrists and ankles. The other ends of the cords were passed around big iron drums which could be turned slowly with a crank. Each time the jailer asks a question, you must answer quickly. If he doesn't like the answer, the crank is given a turn and your arms and legs slowly are drawn from their sockets. It was a machine to force men to tell the truth. Between periods of questioning under this torture, Villon was carefully rested. This in order to keep him from dying too rapidly. And during these rest periods, François Villon became the scholar and the gentleman again. He wrote poetry to keep his mind off his torment. And many authorities tell me that that poetry stands among the masterpieces of the world. After 3 months of the torture, Villon was released from jail. It was now 1451. He was just 30 years of age. But he looked 60. His body was broken and his mind rotted out with alcohol and rage. He was picked up for robbery again, and this time he was punished by a method which is known as pressing for the truth. This saying, which we still use, once meant that you literally applied pressure. Villon was stretched out in a dungeon with weights piled on his chest. With each question, the weights were increased until he was crushed unconscious. Then a rest period and the whole process repeated. Once again, François Villon used the rest periods to seek his once magnificent powers of mind and imagination. And he succeeded. He again wrote poems and songs, which are considered so fine that they are said to be the first good writing in the French language. This time, in the intervals between torture sessions, he wrote love songs to his lost Catherine de Vaucelle. He was turned loose for the last time. He was told that if ever any soldier should see him again in Paris, he would be cut down and killed on sight. And if he did not die at the first attack, he would then be taken and strangled. So in the month of January in 1463, this terrible and unhappy man left Paris. He vanished forever. Maybe he was killed in some brawl or murdered for his pennies or the shirt that he wore. Or maybe death came as a result of the mangling tortures that he had endured. Years later, however, the songs that he had written came to light, and he was proclaimed a genius of the centuries. For apparently, inside the burning body of this monstrous Mr. Hyde, the sane and loving student never quite died. In one of those intervals between the tortures, François Villon wrote, "What does it profit to have drunk the fill of wine, to have reveled and feasted and danced? All joys like these dissolve, and where are they gone? Where are the snows of yesteryear?" Well, we will probably learn how to find last winter's snow again before we will solve the ancient riddle of such divided men as was François Villon, the cutthroat professor of the passing parade. Our time is up. Here's the announcer, and then a brief note on the next edition.
Now again, John Nesbitt.
When we meet again, it will be to follow the final marcher in the group of those who led double lives. In this case, Homer Lee, a very good man and one of the great adventurers of all time. Until then, this is John Nesbitt transcribing from California. A goodbye to you all.
From Hollywood, the Mutual Broadcasting System has brought you the voice of America's foremost teller of tales, John Nesbitt. Listen again tomorrow at this same time. This is the Mutual Don Lee Broadcasting System.